This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. Good morning, Inez.
Good morning. Pinch and hug for the second day of the month.
Oh, a pinch and a hug.
A pinch and a hug. I just thought a pinch and a punch is just so extreme.
It's so extreme.
What about a little hug for the 2nd of April? Come on, guys.
Yeah, I was too late to get anyone for the first day of the month, so maybe I'll pinch and hug someone today.
How have you been?
I've been doing okay. How about you?
I'm good. I heard your incredible broadcast.
Oh.
For Translatable Ability.
Yes.
How was that?
It was, I said in the conversation with Willow, like I do always worry after the two of us talk. I just like worry about Willow all the time. Mm. It sounds horrible over there. And yeah. I don't know. It's like, and yet there is so much incredible organizing. I mean, not and yet, like this is what happens.
Of course.
When people are under immense pressure, they like lean into the networks that they're forced to build. And there's such beautiful expressions of solidarity that are going on in Bristol and in London and then here with the Touch of Grass picnic. Yeah, it was super special. Yeah. Actually, on that, we're going to start off by playing an interview from Willow and my Trans Day of Audibility special broadcast segment, Dispatches from Turf Island, which I also really wanted to call Nevertheless, She Pissed. And it aired this Tuesday.
That is not very professional of me.
No. I mean, that's what I think about, because we were talking about the bathroom bans and Willow was like, yeah, I can't legally now not allowed to use a women's bathroom. And I said, nevertheless, she pissed. And Willow said, yes. But it aired this Tuesday, the 31st of March on 3CR. And in the interview we're going to play, Willow and Alara spoke about experiences of everyday transphobia in Britain and about the life-saving importance of creating intentional community with other trans women. And you can listen back to that segment and the rest of 3CR's Trans Day of Audibility special broadcast by heading to 3cr.org.au/TDOA2026.
And then we hear Leela's interview with Lee and Finn. Now, Lee is a mad and crip person that lives with Emmy and organises with COVID Solidarity Sydney, a project aimed at connecting the politics of sickness to broader liberatory politics. And Finn is a trans mass autistic wheelchair user who was a psychologist but due to burnout now focuses on gardening, craft and building meaningful relationships. And they talk about community care and intersectional principles and unpacking what disability justice looks like. And then...
Oh, go on.
Oh. I was just so excited to talk about this.
Go.
We replay Done by Law's interview with Stacey yesterday, who is a trans writer and advocate and lived experience worker doing vital work through Beyond Bricks and Bars. And Stacey and in Done by Law, they speak about the challenges that trans and gender diverse people face in prison, as well as reintegration within community. And I think really, really importantly, the ongoing administrative challenges that they face, particularly around banking and how that keeps people vulnerable, like how to contact the bank, someone on the outside has to help you contact the bank. That leaves your money vulnerable and you can't have any way to keep an eye on it. So I thought it was a really incredible interview, but you can always catch Done by Law on Tuesdays on 3CR.
Amazing. And then finally, we are joined by Dr. Jake Dizzard, Pennington Institute Research Director, who is speaking with us about Victoria's opioid pharmacotherapy treatment gap. Now, according to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare's most recent report on opioid pharmacotherapy statistics, Victoria is lagging behind other states and territories in really important areas, including public provision of pharmacotherapy services, treatment retention, and matching the rates of opioid use to service delivery resourcing. So it is, an important conversation. And I want to remind you now, and also I will say this around the interview, if you are in Victoria and you're seeking pharmacotherapy-related advocacy, that is support to access pharmacotherapy, if you're having difficulty accessing it, if for some reason you're being blocked from accessing pharmacotherapy, you can contact the PAMS Pharmacotherapy Support Line on 1-800-443. That's 1-800-443 from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday, or you can head to hrvic.org.au/PAMS. It's a really important initiative, especially given the constraints in Victoria's servicing. Now, we are going to head to a little announcement, and then we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Want to become a socially progressive podcaster but don't know where to start?
3CR has a wealth of podcasting knowledge and experience, and we've developed a practical podcast training course to help community voices get into the world of podcasting.
Our two-day in-station course is perfect for new podcasters or people who want to improve their skills and get some insider tips.
Enrol now for our April podcast course.
Full details at 3cr.org.au/podcast services.
Or call the station during business hours on 03 9419 8377.
Enrol now for our April podcast course.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 2nd of April. Now, for First Nations listeners, please note that the first headline contains the name and details of a First Nations person who has died in police custody. Now, for mob-only support, you can always call 13YARN on 139276, or for general support on Lifeline on 131114, or join us again in about 5 minutes. Family remain in the dark as coronial inquest into the death of proud Noongar man Geoffrey Winmar in police custody began on Monday the 30th of March this week. Geoffrey was only 28 when he passed after an incident where multiple police units, including a canine unit, attended his home on November the 9th, 2023. He sadly lost consciousness following a police pursuit and died 2 days later in hospital. Now, the court was told that police cancelled 2 initial calls for an ambulance after Mr. Winmar lost and regained consciousness and then collapsed, with paramedics eventually attending the scene after he had gone into cardiac arrest. Now, the inquest will consider factors including whether earlier medical intervention could have prevented Mr. Winmar's death. With only one body camera recording, the family are seeking justice as the 11 police officers called to give evidence on his death have sought certificates to protect themselves from self-incrimination. Now, if issued, these certificates would protect each of the police members from facing disciplinary action as a result of their evidence. Mr. Winmar's father, Geoffrey Anderson, has said in a statement read out by his daughter Rosie, quote, "What happened to Jeff is not right. Jeff didn't die on his own. There needs to be accountability," unquote. Mr. Winmar's mother, Ursula, said she was looking for justice for her son and she hoped people would be held accountable. Now, the inquest will be run from the 30th of March to the 10th of April, excluding Easter, at the Victorian Coroner's Court, 65 Kavanagh Street, Southbank. The Dajawa Foundation has stated, quote, "Coronial inquests are violent and re-traumatising processes and really unsafe for mob. It's crucial that we fill every seat in the courtroom," unquote. Once again, for mob-only support, you can call 13YARN on 139276.
In international news this week, as the US-Israeli war on Iran continues, conflicting narratives arise from Washington and Tehran. The US has continued to claim that Iran is negotiating a ceasefire, while the IRGC denies any such talks are taking place. bets on oil futures, placed minutes before Trump's announcement, yielded $580 million in profits in the latest case of suspicious trading related to the escalating regional conflict. Contradicting talks of potential negotiations, U.S.-Israeli airstrikes hit one of Iran's largest pharmaceutical companies on Tuesday this week, a facility that produces anti-cancer drugs, anesthetic, and other specialized medicine. While the U.S. has seen growing casualties in a shaky campaign in Iran, Israel has been intensifying its invasion of Lebanon, claiming that it will invade as far as the Litani River, 20 kilometers from the border. In southern Lebanon, two United Nations peacekeepers have been killed and two more injured by indirect artillery fire. More than 1,200 Lebanese people have been killed and 1.2 million displaced since the beginning of March this year.
Also in headlines, in Sudan, an attack carried out by the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF, and allies the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, north on Tuesday this week, has killed at least 14 people in South Kordofan. The Sudan Doctors Network reports that casualties include five children and two women, with shelling of residential areas in the city of Diling, also wounding at least another 23 people. Now, both the RSF and the Sudanese Armed Forces, or the SAF, have used drone strikes extensively throughout the conflict, with the intensity of the drone warfare increasing in Darfur and the Kordofan regions. As of mid-March, the United Nations Human Rights Office reports that over 500 Sudanese civilians have been killed in drone strikes alone this year. The international medical group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, also released a report this week documenting the widespread use of sexual violence against Sudanese women and girls as a weapon of war. Now, MSF reported that their facilities treated at least 3,396 survivors of sexual violence between January 2024 and November 2025.
In other news this week, in a landmark decision on Tuesday, the Fair Work Commission said it would scrap discounted pay rates for employees aged 18 to 20, saying they should receive the full award wage. 500,000 junior workers in sectors such as fast food, retail, and pharmacy will receive a boost in their pay, putting them on a more even field with their older colleagues. The wage rises will be phased in over 4 years in a landmark change that unions compared to the introduction of equal pay for women in the 1970s. 18 to 20-year-old workers will need to be with an employer for 6 months to receive the adult rate. However, minors under 18 years old will still receive junior rates. The SDA, which is the union representing retail, warehousing, and fast food workers, said it welcomed the decision but would be pushing for the overdue change to be applied as quickly as possible.
Finally, in headlines, in an emergency address delivered at 7 p.m. last night, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced that the Australian government has adopted a national fuel security plan to address the impacts of global fuel shortages caused by the US-Israeli war on Iran. Now, key measures introduced include a halving of the fuel excess, a 26% cut per litre to petrol taxes, and a complete suspension of the heavy vehicle road user charge. Measures will be in place for the next 3 months, with fuel prices across the country immediately reflecting yesterday's excess cut. Albanese also encouraged increased use of public transport to ease fuel pressures, a point that echoes the Victorian government's temporary suspension of fares across metropolitan and VLAN services for the entire month of April. Now, Anthony Albanese was one of the first world leaders to express support for the US-Israeli war on Iran, which began on the 28th of February this year with the assassination of the head of state Ali Khamenei and other senior members of the Iranian political and military leadership. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 2nd of April. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass destruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis. Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM and it is 7:16 in the morning. And we're now going to listen to an interview from the Trans Day of Audibility special broadcast segment that I produced this year with my friend Willow. It was called Dispatches from Turf Island and it aired this Tuesday, the 31st of March on 3CR. In the segment that we're going to play, Willow and her friend Alara speak about experiences of everyday transphobia in Britain and about the life-saving importance of creating intentional community with other trans women. You can listen back to this segment and the rest of 3CR's Trans Day of Audibility special broadcast by heading to 3cr.org.au/TDOA2026.
I'm here with my friend Alara today, a longtime collaborator, co-organizer, and I'm just going to pass it to you, Alara, and let you introduce yourself.
Amazing. Thank you, Willow. I am Alara Sinodere Ala, she, her, mixed desi transsexual woman. I've been community organizing for over a decade. I founded with my friends founded the Trans Feminist Collective in Bristol. I have a lot of experiences, sort of very racialized experiences, but also as a lesbian trans woman as well, both sort of like in London, in Bristol, and in like the UK as a whole.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Alara. I mean, bouncing off of that directly, I wanted to open this interview by just asking, are you okay? Are we okay? Is anyone okay? What is daily life like for you right now?
Wow. Yeah, so I feel like the place to start from is like no. Obviously, super duper no. Things have been getting harder and harder. It's difficult, right? Because there's like a tension that exists between this like my own experience and my own growth into my womanhood and feelings of being like more and more empowered. More and more I feel sort of passively a woman, less like I need to try. And that's sort of part of my own journey with it. But that I have found contrasts with the state of the country, because as I've become more comfortable in myself, things have been getting more and more hostile. And I see it in the women around me as well. Things are getting more and more and more stressful for us.
And on that note, I wanted to ask you, maybe for the listeners back in Nam, how would you kind of summarise what has changed in the UK since the EHRC ruling, and what have you noticed in the changes in the way the public treats trans people?
So there's like a demonisation, right? And it's really, you feel it. You really feel it. Like I am lucky in the sense that I've never had like a horrible encounter in the bathroom, but I've not been given side eyes. And like, you know, the way that like kids will like yell stuff and like will harass you and will like chase you. I have noticed an increase in the hostility towards trans women, specifically and visibly trans women. And I found that when I first came out, cis girls were very, oh, you look so pretty. Oh, like, you know, where'd you get those trousers? And like nowadays, like if I get clocked, if my tee is clocked, then they see me and they're like, oh, like giving me little side looks and being super duper uncomfortable.
Something that a lot of trans people talk about is like the privatization of violence. Mm. You know, you have like these big state legal handing downs and rulings, and then that becomes something that is diffused through the public and it's enacted every day by people in bathrooms, people on the street, you know, the small kind of micro interactions and the microaggressions. It's definitely something I've noticed since I arrived here. Would you say it's something that you've kind of noticed has changed the way it feels to be trans in public?
Definitely. Mm. And the like the necessity of performativity, like and as like a brown trans girl as well, like the necessity to pass increases like, you know, iteratively as like the years go on. And like Britain is such like a society so couched in class and hierarchy that like You can be as anti-class, anti-hierarchical, you could be, you know, the most biggest anarchist in the world. But, like, I found that, like, even cis anarchists are getting weird about trans people in their spaces. And that, like, we have a culture here where whatever is decided in parliament becomes the social norm. And, like, there is resistance. There is definitely resistance. But that resistance is so much more polarized than it's ever been before. People absorb the culture of the class that's in charge, and they emulate it.
This is something I've really noticed, is that in the institutions in public life, whether that's workplaces or universities or kind of the social groups, there is this, like, disappearing of, like, that kind of progressive window that opened in the 2010s. You know, there is much less often pronoun badges at the conference. There's much less often the protections at work that, you know, looked like they were coming through in the 2010s. But I guess the question I've got is, how does like the community respond to that? Like, how have you noticed your friends, people in your life who are trans, how have they responded to this change? How is it affecting people's mental health? How's it affecting how it is to live?
I think, like, the response, especially, I think, post, like, liberal washing, which is what I would call that period in the 2010s, I don't think we were ever going to get the things we were promised. Always very deeply cynical of that, and from, like, the perspective as a Marxist and all these other things, like, this stuff is always about holding up the class that exists. I think our community has responded in extremely understandably very, like, strongly emotional ways, right? Like, mental health is so much worse. And people are feeling much worse. And there is so much anger. There is so much, like, there is this, like, twin thing of, like, this intense galvanization and this, like, desperate need to do something, to resist. And at the same time, this relentless sense of just, like, crushing, exhaustive hope. Like, we are all spent. We are so tired. We are, like, not sleeping, not eating. Like, we are, like, finding the need to be together so much more important, but at the same time, like, I see everyone, like, closing in and pushing out simultaneously.
Yeah, that really resonated with me, that kind of window, the liberal window you talked about. I mean, I think all of us have kind of always known that the cosmetics companies are not going to save us, the corporate pride is not going to save us, the representation is not going to be the thing that lifts, you know, poor trans people out of poverty, that spotlights anyone except a few white celebrities. But I guess in the face of that realization, it's still crushing to kind of experience this gender fascism slamming down on all of us, you know? I think you can still feel a bit nostalgic for, like, neoliberal corporate pride when the alternative is ruthless gender fascism. But I wonder on that, like, what does keep you going? What kind of responses are you seeing in the community that kind of give you hope or at least galvanize you?
That's so important, because obviously, like, you know, we've got to celebrate the victories where they exist, right? Because it feels very few and far between. My strength is very personal, comes from my friends and, like, the community that we've managed to build, especially out here in Bristol. You've been a big part of that as well. Like, in the past year or so, the trans feminist collective is not even a year old at the time we're doing this interview. And, like, in that time, there was no real voice for trans women in this city, like, independently. You know, there's a lot of misogyny in the queer scene. And something that I'm still facing is that, like, there's a lot of, like, you know, inherent and implicit racism. And so the thing that keeps me going personally is the relationships I've developed with all of the, like, incredibly beautiful and talented and just, like, driven and insane and, like, you know, like, really sort of, like, you've known this, you've met the British trans women, like, there's an intensity here, like, an emotional intensity. I can't speak to what it's like in Nam, but, like,
I think the stakes are higher here. I would say that in a lot of ways, the stakes are a lot higher.
And so, like, it produces this kind of, like, group of incredibly, like, emotionally vibrating people. And I have so much love and respect for, like, the peers that I've, you know, come up with. And it's those people that, like, really drives it. And also just seeing, like, another generation of women who've come out post-COVID and being able to hold space for them and build community for them is... I'm so tired and exhausted, but also so happy that there is a space with other trans women that wasn't there when I came out.
This is it. I think this is a space to come together and be together by us and for us is a singular achievement. And like you said, it's not even a year old, but yeah, I think it's something to be really proud of. I'm going to end on a slightly lighter note and ask you, for the listeners back home, is there any UK-specific slang, trans slang or broader that you could share to just give a slice of life over here?
Let me give you a little slice, babe. Let me give you some slices. There's like, I feel like, you know, as is the way across, like, a lot of the doll communities, like, a lot of it is just been imported. It's like AAVE, like, Borum, like, slang from New York and from the Borum scene in London. So I feel like a lot of the doll slang, it's very hard to say what's, like, UK-specific without, like, claiming someone else's culture. Mm. But, like, I don't know, I'm always dropping, like, London bits, like, you know, bits in it. You ask me something, you're like, you'll tell me, like, I bought a new top today. It's really cute. I'll be like, is it? You know, like that kind of.
So confusing.
Yeah, and I'm just I'm just like everyone's saying all right to each other as well. Mm. You know, I'm slightly self-conscious because my girlfriend says my slang is like, you know, from 2010, but like I'm a girl of an age from a city of a time. You know, I can't help it. Yeah. It's not my fault. But like apart from like the classics, like. Wow, this is, man, allow it. Mm. Meaning stop. There you go.
I like it.
You like that?
Let's allow it. thank you so much, Lara, for chatting.
I love that segment so much because I was also reflecting with Willow afterwards about the fact that like allow it and is it are things that are just like very familiar to me hearing, like talking to my British, like South Asian cousins. And Alara is absolutely right. That is a particular slang from a place, from a time. Girl, we're all getting older, you know, and sometimes we have to face facts. But that was a conversation between Willow and Alara from Willow and my Trans Day of Audibility special broadcast segment, Dispatches from Turf Island, which aired this Tuesday, the 31st of March. And you can listen back to the whole Trans Day of Audibility special broadcast, as well as the whole of Willow and my segment, by heading to 3cr.org.au /TDOA2026. It is 7:28 in the morning. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast.
And now we will hear from Leela's interview with Lee and Finn. And Lee is a mad and crip person that lives with Emmy and organises with COVID Solidarity Sydney, a project aimed at collecting politics and sickness. And Finn is a trans mad autistic wheelchair user who is a psychologist but now really focuses on gardening and craft and building meaningful relationships. And in his first interview, they will discuss community care and disability justice.
Finn and Lee, would you be able to start by introducing yourselves in whatever way you feel is appropriate and describe your current community care and or liberatory practices?
My name is Lee. I use they, them pronouns. I ID as a non-binary mad person and also a crip. In terms of my current community care practices, I think that also links to stuff I'm really passionate about. So I guess for the context of this interview, I practice COVID precautions and have consistently taken COVID precautions since the beginning of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I think for me that ties in deeply with community care because it's about thinking about who is disposable and also why they are disposable, as in why the state would consider certain people disposable and mm-hmm. like the systems of power that currently exist. Mm-hmm. I think that practicing COVID precautions is one way of pushing back against those ideas and like normalizing the idea that some people deserve to die or some people deserve to be isolated or disabled or further disabled.
Yeah, hi, I'm Finn. I'm a trans mask wheelchair user. I use he, they pronouns. For me, when it comes to concepts around like community care and disability justice, like those are quite intertwined, and some of the practices that might be involved in that for me that I take on a day-to-day basis do include things like continuing to mask in public spaces, or being like having conversations with the people I interact with around their COVID precautions and levels of risk. And that is heavily influenced by my values around disability and ensuring like access in my relationships between people. But unfortunately, it doesn't always translate when some of those relationships aren't reciprocating. And then it also comes around in like sort of little everyday interactions on the individual level. Ways of engaging with like community care can be simple things that I might do, like cooking a meal and sharing food or driving places. And that's something that's quite important to me, that's within my capacity as like a disabled person.
Starting off from a really basic level, I guess, even assuming someone has never heard of it, what is disability justice to you? And do you want to share any living experiences that you've had that contribute to how you conceptualize disability justice and enact it now?
Yeah, so my understanding of disability justice evolved from a lot of the work that has been done by SINS Invalid in the States. And they've got a wonderful document. It is geared towards more like events and meetings and groups around how to enact these principles. And they do outline principles of disability justice. From what I know, like at the core of it is you can't have a sort of approach to disability that ignores other aspects of people's lived experiences. So the way that a wheelchair user who's Aboriginal and autistic and trans would vary quite differently their experience of disability to a white cis male who uses a wheelchair. And it's about acknowledging those differences and how that can impact your access to community, to care, or to different spaces, and how you're often excluded from those spaces if you don't meet this model image of disability. So it goes beyond the disability rights movement quite a bit, which just focuses more on the legal aspect of disability rather than looking towards like how it's a complex experience where we cannot ignore the whole person and their experiences.
I think I really agree with that, and I also learnt from a similar place. And I would also say I learnt a lot from Finn, who really broadened my understanding of disability and deepened it deeply.
Yeah, I think like interacting with disabled community is really such a big aspect of learning more about like disability justice. Yeah,
definitely. I think something that separates disability justice from my previous kind of understandings was that I had previously kind of thought about disability in this like 101 access way, in this like inclusion way. And I think ultimately sometimes, I mean, access is incredibly important. Like, I'm not trying to disregard that. But I think when we don't put it in a broader kind of like framework or around power and the structures that surround us, I think it kind of leans more towards like assimilation and how can we fit into the world as it exists and like reform it enough to allow disabled people to exist, as opposed to like, what does freedom really look like and how is our freedom interlinked?
A big part of it, I think that really appealed to me when I was learning more about it and engaging with community members, is the idea that we are all deserving of care, not just the people who fit into a specific image of disabled. It's beyond like even the people who you might not feel comfortable with, they still deserve care and understanding and inclusion and compassion. But that is often like not carried out particularly well in a lot of spaces, I've found, where we'll turn away from the less, I'm going to use quotation marks, partible disabled people in order to kind of prioritize a specific image of disability. And I think acting on principles of like disability justice would be trying to expand that idea of who our community is. And like I've seen people talk about community, and then when you try to ask them to describe who that actually means, they often refer to people more in like their immediate like social circles. I've seen this a lot in queer spaces as a queer person, where it's like, oh yeah, I like hanging out with like other trans people, and it's like, cool, does that include trans people who haven't like transitioned? Does it include trans people who still ID as trans but have detransitioned? Does it include non-white trans people, disabled trans people? And often it doesn't. And that actually ties in with this idea of disability justice, where it's not just about looking to community as this single like insular group of people that you like. Community includes the people you don't like as well.
Yeah,
it includes people who don't agree with you, people who have different capacities, abilities, opinions, beliefs, backgrounds, and that I think gets overlooked a lot.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
March 15 was Long COVID Awareness Day. And like many other infectious diseases, COVID and the wide array of post-viral illnesses that people can develop as a result of infection are kind of examples of preventable harm. Can you expand on the idea that disability is socially produced, meaning that a lot of the things that cause people to experience disability are to do with, I guess, cultural attitudes and like social behaviors? Do you have any critical reflections on that idea?
I would contest the idea that disability is socially produced. I think I don't disagree with the idea that a very large aspect of it is absolutely informed by like cultural attitudes, like barriers that are in fact socially produced. But I think there are also aspects of disability that are kind of just inherent to the diversity of the human condition. I think perhaps one example of that is like pain and fatigue. It's a conversation I have a lot with like fellow disabled people, is the idea that like the proliferation of the model of the social model of disability sometimes can cause a little bit of shame for disabled people who actually do think that our disabilities do kind of stop us from doing things.
Yeah, I think part of the social model's failings, like I do agree with quite a lot of it, but part of its failings is it does tend to present disability in a way where, oh, if you make X accommodations, person's not going to be disabled anymore, which is can be really dismissive of disabled experiences, and also doesn't recognize, because of the diversity of disability, there can be conflicting access needs. And something that like comes to mind is when I went to a specific disability caucus, the temperature of the room, like a lot of disabilities affect your capacity to regulate temperature and sensitivity to temperature. Most people were struggling because they were cold. I struggle with heat though. So as soon as they turned the heat on, I couldn't breathe properly anymore and I had to leave. However, the hotter temperature was more suitable for a lot of the other disabled people in attendance. So there was conflicting access needs, and there's not really a suitable accommodation to navigate that. We can't really have two different temperatures in the same room. It's a bit funny. But in terms of how this relates to infectious illnesses and the sort of outcomes of that, we do know that like COVID is preventable, and many infectious illnesses are preventable by taking appropriate precautions. And this can look different in a variety of contexts, and it's definitely an ongoing conversation I have with people in my life, making adjustments around how we engage in precautions. but it's also something that hasn't really been taken on board in a community-wide sense from what I've seen for things like specific trans events or even disabled events where they might not have any particular requirements around masking. They might not have things like air purifiers or air filtration systems. And what that can do is completely exclude the people who are trying to take those precautions to look after not just themselves and prevent any further disability or new disability, but also how they are like engaging with community. It stops them from being able to show up.
I think it's also important to think about the fact that pandemics are also shaped by the world that we live in. So like capitalism and settler colonialism play a really big part in pandemics arising and also becoming more frequent, and also how fast and how far they spread.
Oh, I was just going to say on that sort of topic of how capitalism is underlying a lot of these issues. We've seen this very clearly with COVID, where there was this whole massive push for return to normal. And what is the purpose of that? When we actually look at that, is the purpose of that because COVID has been eliminated? No, it has not. It's definitely not eliminated. Is the purpose to help support people's mental well-being? That's another one I've seen around. No, they cut funding to psychological services, and they have, like, there's so many issues with our healthcare system, and then there's just ridiculous amounts of like access issues for like events and community participation. We have a lack of like free public spaces and all of these issues. What is the driving force around pushing the wider community to return to normal, to not mask anymore, to go out, to do things that are high risk behaviors, infectious behaviors? Mm. It's going to be money. It's the economic impact of the pandemic that was the push. And I think if we're ignoring that, we're just kind of going along assuming that the government is always acting in our best interest, which is a very interesting take to have, particularly for people in like queer disabled community who often are directly targeted by government agencies and legal issues because of our very existence.
On the topic of things we can do together, what are some ways that we can collaborate with and support our immediate community to increase sickness safety practices and integrate the ideas of disability justice that both of you have covered?
If I were to focus on infection control, I think things like implementing masks, providing tests if possible, asking people to test, and still doing some level of contact tracing. And that could be people volunteering up information, letting organizers of an event know that they were sick after the event so that that can be passed on to other attendees. I think it is also important to recognize that there are barriers to implementing these practices, like, for example, conflicting access needs sometimes, like some people can't mask, like that's definitely something to consider. But I think it's about how can we harm minimize in a principled way, as opposed to kind of like have this attitude of like, oh, it's too hard to implement this, or like it's just too far gone. Because the ideas of like every chain of transmission that we break tangibly saves lives, like that is still true, like it still prevents death and disablement. But I do want to also acknowledge things like funding, money, like individual access to like masks and tests and other PPE is like very shaped by access to like money.
I think like on an individual level, something that I've had come up when I talk about COVID and masking is like, oh, but nobody else is masking anymore, so I didn't feel like I needed to. And it's then trying to open up conversation and also challenging that idea of, well, nobody else is doing it, so why should I? And going, well, is that really how you want to live your life? Is that really a principled way to live your life? Like, I came out as trans over a decade ago in Southeast Queensland. there weren't trans people in my life or around me, if I decided that, oh, nobody else is doing it, so I'm not going to, then it could have taken me years longer before I got to a point where I was comfortable in who I am and my body and my existence. It could have delayed so many important aspects of my transition. And I find it a little bit difficult when people in like trans disabled community or broader queer disabled community take that sort of approach, but to COVID precautions instead. Oh, nobody else is doing it, so why should I? And it does, it just, it's this odd disconnect in my brain around that, letting your behavior be shaped by what you see. It also ignores that if you start doing it, then that could be the push for other people in your life or people who interact more tangentially with you to start as well. And it's not as easy as I might make it sound. I definitely have people in my life who I've had these conversations with and their behavior hasn't changed. But it doesn't mean I'm going to stop asking them to do a test, a RAT test, when I come visit. It doesn't mean I'm going to stop asking them to, you know, wear a mask when we go to an event or things like that. And then on the more community, higher level community sort of aspect of it, and we see a lot with like events when it comes to planning, is they don't typically include disability as a consideration unless it's as an afterthought. It's not there from the get-go as part of the plan. It's just tacked on at the end, if at all. And it seems to be, from what I've encountered at least, quite similar for COVID precautions. They might not even consider it. Someone might say something and then they'll tack on a little statement a couple of days before the event, being like, oh, hey, we should, like, you should mask if you can. And that's kind of the extent of it. However, there are people out there who are doing amazing work trying to ensure that they're considering this from the get-go, and what that looks like can be consulting with some of the groups who are working around disseminating information on COVID and presenting that, and building like understanding of ways that we can practice these precautions sustainably.
Like, as much frustration as I sometimes experience, I think I really value not taking like a punitive approach and instead thinking about like, what are the barriers? Especially when I'm amongst like peers who really care about building a better world, there's often like cognitive dissonance or like misinformation at play. And I think addressing that, as well as some of the barriers to like accessing resources to be able to take precautions. I also think it's important to like remember that ultimately this shouldn't be an individual responsibility, but because of the way that things have rolled out, we are forced to take this on as an individual responsibility. I think it's also important to remember like people who cannot take precautions because of like, say, the settings or like conditions they live in. Mm-hmm. For example, it's like pretty hard to be like purifying the air or like wearing masks constantly if you're like sleeping rough, like, or a carceral setting like in prison or in a psych ward.
I wanted to finish by asking both of you, do you have any resource recommendations for people who are getting curious about disability justice and sickness safety, or people that want to update themselves on their own practices?
So I'm part of a collective called COVID Solidarity Sydney. Sydney is in air quotes. And we do put out resources. We particularly have a focus on connecting the pandemic to kind of like broader movements and like broader politics as well. But also Clean Air Club is a really great resource. Yeah. I would say also one of my favorites is Health Self-Defense. There are heaps of mask blogs where you can get free PPE, and they also release like information.
Thing on the disability justice front, I mentioned earlier Sins Invalid, and they are US based and they have some resources on their website. There is a fee, but you can access a downloadable PDF copy of, I think it's called Skin, Tooth and Bone, which is the sort of guide outlining a lot of the principles of disability justice and how to enact it, particularly in like community spaces. And then one that I particularly enjoyed is a book, and that's Care Work, Dreaming of Disability Justice. Care Work is such a huge foundational text when starting to explore disability justice, in my opinion. And it's one that I pushed everyone in my life to read.
Including me.
Yes, got Lee to read it. I recommend, I use support workers on weekdays, and I got the support workers to read it. It does share a lot of practical ways to engage with disability and disability justice, and also just general like stories and experiences that can be really eye-opening for people who are new to exploring this and trying to understand this.
Thank you both so much for speaking with me today. Yeah, I really appreciate your insights, your time, your energy, and your care.
Thanks.
And that was Leela's wonderful interview with Lee and Finn, who are MAD and CRIP people, and as well as a trans mass autistic wheelchair user, who speak about meaningful relationships, unpacking disability justice, and yeah, what it means to shape that informed care into your everyday life and into your practices. And yeah, you're listening to 3CR 855 AM. It's currently 7:51.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. You're joined by me, Inez, and Priya in the studio. And now we are going to replay an interview that Done by Law did yesterday with Stacey, a writer and advocate with lived experience of incarceration, who does vital decarceration work through Beyond Bricks and Bars. Now, Stacey's work spans media, community advocacy, and justice reform. And in this interview, they'll discuss key challenges that trans and gender diverse people face in prison, in reintegration, as well as ongoing administrative challenges like banking.
If you're a trans girl and you're in the men's system, all the programs are for men.
Yes.
And all the facilities are for men. All the recreation is for men. All the clothes, like everything. So, yeah, you're in an entire environment where you are expected to submit to that binary.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's just like conversion therapy, like I was saying. It's quite hard. And the problem that I had was that the biggest problem was that there's policies and procedures, but, like, there's not really, I mean, let's be honest, there's no compliance.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like anyone's making sure anyone's following policies and procedures.
Mm.
And you're a criminal, so no one believes anything you say. So it's almost like the trust system, I suppose. They just assume everyone's following policies and procedures, mm-hmm. which my experience was, my time in custody was not the case?
Thanks for that, Stacey. So we hear about often overrepresentation and vulnerability, that part you've just alluded to. What do you think is misunderstood or overlooked when it comes to trans people in prison? That's a big question, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it comes down to my experience, the intersectionality of it all.
Mm.
So if you're like a lovely, white, cisgendered man, heterosexual, come from a good family, your problem is that you broke the law and went to prison. Mm. But it's like when you're dealing with a cohort like transgender people, we are marginalized already.
Mm.
So we are already in the media and being, like, I grew up with Jerry Springer and everyone making fun of trans people.
Yeah.
So you add that to the mix for someone who is already vulnerable.
Yes.
And then maybe someone's turned to drugs or something to try and deal with these issues.
Yeah.
And going to service providers as well can be hard. It was hard for me to reach out to places like the Salvation Army because of the religious connotations.
Mm-hmm.
It can be, you just sometimes expect a negative encounter, so you just don't try.
Yeah.
So I think it's the intersectionality of it. There are so many issues and you have to try and put out all these different spot fires in your life and your mental health. And it's so hard to find some place that will help do that.
Yeah.
Which is where Beyond Bricks and Bars came from originally. Yes. It was sort of grew up organically from that need.
Yes. Okay. And when did you found out about Bricks and Bars? While you were on In the Inside or out when you came out?
While I was in custody, so me and a couple of other trans girls were in custody. And at the time when we were in custody, the commissioner's requirements were called the management of, I think it was transvestites or transsexuals. Mm. So we were treated quite badly.
Yeah.
And one of my colleagues, they wrote a letter pretty much just to everyone. And the person who answered was Whit Gorry. And so Whit started Beyond Bricks and Bars, like a grassroots sort of thing.
Right.
So, yeah, I was lucky to be on board almost from day one.
Right.
And get that help. And it was like a huge change,
yeah.
That help, because it was before then I had kind of like died inside, like I was defeated. Uh-huh. And I was just laying down, just utterly defeated. And then someone on the outside stepped up to help. And with that help, with someone there, I could sort of get up and advocate again.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest issue, I guess, was like the biggest change was I just needed to be witnessed, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I just needed my suffering to be seen by someone and acknowledged and know that someone cared that I was doing so badly.
Yeah.
Mm.
Oh, wow. That's thank you so much for, you know, sharing that with us, because that's very personal. And, you know, like, I'm sure that's taking you back somewhere that was really difficult. So thank you for that. So should we talk about some of the stuff and the work that you've been doing post-release, because you have been doing like amazing work by your biography, and you know, there's been lots of things that I've come across. And this is like, you know, a very personal, you know, it's the personal is, what's the word, the personal is the political. And And you have been working in a number of organisations and writing and stuff. So where do you see the systemic gaps and when we're talking about reintegration to things like just even basic services?
Yeah, so I feel like, I'm not sure if other people agree with me or not, but I feel like criminalized people, it's still completely socially acceptable to discriminate against criminals.
Mm.
And that turns into politicians winning points by using criminals as pawns in their game of politics. And so it's like we're not really people. And so I think one of the biggest gaps to start off with is the fact that it's okay to treat us terribly.
Mm.
And so when you're coming out of custody, it's everyone in the community expects you to reintegrate, but so many people won't let you reintegrate. Mm-hmm. And it's like an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're expected to achieve the impossible.
Mm.
And then you see people who, like, I've done court reporting before in my work with About Time, and I've sat in on cases, and there was like people were saying to the magistrates, I want to reintegrate, but I can't get a job.
Yeah.
I can't find work anywhere,
mm-hmm.
but I can go and go back to selling drugs.
Yeah.
And I can make money.
Yeah.
And I have children who I have to feed, and I have rent that I have to pay.
Yeah.
What do you want me to do?
Mm.
And I think that's probably the biggest gap is that it's like all of society in Australia as a whole seems to think that tough on crime and all of those things are a solution, and driving people to the fringes of society is a solution, where these aren't solutions.
Yeah.
Like, and this won't work. And you look at places overseas and like different countries who have recidivism rates that are so low, and yet when some politicians get asked about these, their answer is, we're Australia and we'll find Australian solutions. And to me, that sounds kind of arrogant.
Mm.
You know, like I'm confident that if that politician had brain cancer, he wouldn't be looking for an Australian solution. He'd just be looking for a solution.
The best solution.
Yeah. Like he'd want to fix it. Yeah. Yeah. But when it comes to us who have been in custody and have been criminalized, you know, they just want to win votes.
Yeah.
They want to run scare campaigns.
Yes.
And the problem is that when people want to, you run the risk, if you want to correct the story or put people straight, then you'll become a target.
Yeah.
And yeah, so people don't really want to speak out against things, I suppose, unless you have no skeletons in the closet.
yes, indeed. But we have spoken a bit about issues around banking, which is what we first connected before asking you to come in today. And you've been doing some work in that area. So would you like to talk about what the barriers are and what the issues are for people with things around that?
Yeah, sure. So I've been doing some work with VACRO around the Customer-Owned Banking Code of Practice Review.
Yes.
So I've been looking at issues that face people who are coming out of, well, in custody and coming out of custody. And there's a lot of issues. So a common thing that happens is when you go into custody, you'll get debanked.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you're in custody for, I don't know, 10 years. So you're constantly, what happens is you've just been given 10 years.
Yeah.
So all you really care about is, I just got 10 years.
Yes.
I'm going to be in jail for 10, oh my God.
Yes.
You're not really thinking about, like, your direct debits.
Yeah.
And your Netflix.
Yeah.
And all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And so you don't have a job now.
Yes.
So your bank account is being direct debited still.
Yeah.
And you're getting bank fees to the point where your bank account will close and now you have no bank account.
Yeah.
So some of the things around that that happened, since that's a common occurrence.
So you don't get notified either? Like, how would you know that that's happening?
You don't generally know. So because you're in custody and because your agency's been taken away from you.
Yeah.
What will happen in intake is you will be asked about your bank account,
mm-hmm.
and whether or not you want to talk to a financial counsellor, which, depending on things, they might say, do you want to talk to a financial counsellor? And you're on remand and you're like, no, I'm going to get bail, thinking you're going to get bail, and then maybe bail's knocked back. Or you're awaiting sentencing and you're like, no, it should be fine. I'm just expecting 3 months. And then you get, like, 2 years, or you get 10 years, and the shock of that sentence makes you despondent and you just don't care.
Mm.
Like, I don't care about my bank account. I'm not getting out anyway.
Mm.
So that's, like, a common thing, and the banks don't generally, I mean, I'm not sure if they get notified. Some of the people that I spoke to, because I ran a workshop, one of them was telling me that they were receiving letters from the bank saying that they owed money and things like that, and getting a letter with their bank statement sent to them in prison. And then when they finally contacted the bank and said, how come you've still been taking fees out and everything? How come you're letting my direct debits come out? And the bank said, oh, we didn't know you were in prison. But they're sending them letters in prison. And that it was their responsibility to tell them that they were in prison. But the bank clearly knew.
Yeah.
And so an issue that comes up is, on one hand, you have no bank account.
Yeah.
Or on the other hand, you do have a bank account and you can't access it because you're in custody. You can't email the bank. You can't call them because you need to have a person of... Like, I'm calling Stacey Stokes and here's Stacey's number. So you need a contact person so that the prisons can run restraining orders and stuff. You can't just put down, like, I'm calling the Commonwealth Bank, and they'll say, how do we know your ex doesn't live there, work there or something?
Mm.
So they might knock that back. So you can't contact the bank per se. So I might say, Liz, can you contact the bank on my behalf? And you say, sure, give me your bank details.
Mm.
And I give you my bank details, and then I get out of custody and find my bank account missing $50,000. Mm. Like, that happens regularly because they need someone on the outside to access the bank account. And you're not going to see that person for 10 years. They're not going to find out for 10 years that you've just cleared out their bank account. And then the other part of it is this person has been debanked.
Mm.
So they have no bank account at all. So when they're getting out, they're like, Centrelink might say, okay, well, we need to, where are we going to pay your Centrelink money? And they'll say, oh, okay, well, like, my ex, I'm going to get out and I'll stay with them for a bit. You can pay into my ex's account. And all of a sudden, you're now in a position of financial coercion where your ex has control of all of your money and your welfare payment and everything. And it's all really just because you can't just contact the bank.
Hi,
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You've just heard an interview Done by Law did with Stacey this week, a trans writer and advocate with lived experience of incarceration who does vital work through Beyond Bricks and Bars. And they spoke about the challenges with Done by Law that transgender diverse people face in prison, as well as reintegration within the community and ongoing administrative challenges like banking that keep people vulnerable. And you can catch the full interview by heading to Done by Law on 3cr.org.au/Done by Law and catch them on Tuesdays on 3CR at 6 to 6.30.
Amazing. And for our final interview for today, we are joined by Dr. Jake Dizzard, Pennington Institute Research Director, who is speaking with us about Victoria's opioid pharmacotherapy treatment gap. Now, according to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare's most recent National Opioid Pharmacotherapy Statistics Annual Data Collection Report, Victoria is lagging behind other states and territories in crucial areas, including the public provision of pharmacotherapy services, treatment retention, and matching rates of opioid use to service delivery resourcing. Now, I just wanted to share a couple of resources with folks if you are requiring pharmacotherapy-related advocacy. PAMS Pharmacotherapy Support Line is available with Harm Reduction Victoria on 1-800-443 from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday, or you can head to hrvic.org.au/PAMS. For Victorian statewide-based AOD support and referral pathways, you can call Direct Line on 1-800-888-236. That's 1-800-888-236 24/7. And you can also look for your local community health services for AOD services and pharmacotherapy support and advice. And also just a reminder to folks to carry naloxone around, but also remember that other forms of pharmacotherapy that are longer acting require different responses. So get informed and keep your community safe. And if you do need support, again, you can call Direct Line to access that support and head to your local community health services. Now we are joined by Dr. Jake Dizzard. Good morning.
Morning, Priya. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Well, thanks for joining us. To begin with, can you break down the role of opioid pharmacotherapy in minimizing harm and supporting the management of opioid dependence? What kinds of pharmacotherapy treatments are available in Victoria?
Sure. So opioid pharmacotherapy is really basically the gold standard of treatment for opioid dependence. And it has actually a lot of different names, including in other states in Australia, but maybe the most direct is opioid substitution therapy, because that's what it really is. Instead of unmanaged dosing of prescription opioids or illicit ones like heroin, you substitute longer-acting prescribed drugs, mainly methadone and buprenorphine, and you take them in a prescribed manner. And so as many listeners will know, opioid dependence is associated with intense cravings and withdrawal symptoms. So the point of these drugs is to limit these symptoms and help people stabilize and assert more control over their drug use and their lives. And so as far as the kinds of treatment, the classic that most listeners will have heard of probably, so to speak, classic drug is pharmacotherapy drug is methadone, which is most commonly taken as a liquid once daily. But the majority of Australians actually now take a different drug, buprenorphine, which comes in various forms, including sublingual and long-release injection. But regardless of what the drug is, the evidence is very clear. The treatment saves lives and increases people's well-being, which is why it's so important that people can access it whenever they're ready to do so.
Yeah, thank you very much for just providing that explanation, because I think it really sets the scene for the conversation we're going to have about the treatment gap that exists in Victoria. And the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare's latest annual data collection report on opioid pharmacotherapy statistics was published late last month and identified that 3 in 4 pharmacotherapy prescribers in Australia worked in the private sector in 2025. And Victoria was the only state or territory with no public prescribers. Now, what implications does that have for treatment accessibility?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. On some level, that statistic is actually slightly deceiving because there are doctors working in public hospitals in Victoria and in community health centers that prescribe methadone and buprenorphine. But overall, it's definitely true that we have a more privatized model, particularly in comparison to New South Wales. So in NSW, where they have a more public clinic-based system, there are some real benefits to that, including streamlined access to complementary like wraparound services and more access to addiction medicine specialists. On the other hand, there are some things that people like about the Victorian system. You know, there's a certain relationship that people build by going to a GP, and there's a certain level of privacy for dosing at a pharmacy rather than a big public clinic. But the biggest issue in Victoria is that there's just a huge amount of instability in our system because we don't have the public clinics as a backstop when something happens. So what makes the system in Victoria so fragile in recent years is that we're really quite dependent on a very small number of doctors who are the prescribers for hundreds, sometimes even maybe over 1,000 patients. So if one of these doctors, and a lot of them are getting older or nearing retirement age, so if one of them retires or loses prescribing privileges, there can be a real crisis because there isn't this network of public clinics like in some other places to sort of serve as a backstop, take up the slack. So this happened most recently a couple years ago in Frankston, and the state government did a decent job of reacting, but it really had to scramble. So this top-heavy, it's the combination of this top-heaviness with these high-volume prescribers in this privatized system, and that makes us vulnerable in Victoria.
Yeah, well, I think it is really important to have a grasp of the sort of system ecology that produces impacts for people who are trying to access pharmacotherapy support. And I understand that Victoria also had one of the lowest treatment retention rates across all states and territories, but on the other hand, has quite high rates of unmet demand. Could you explain why that might be the case?
Right. Yeah, so the retention rate from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare data is a little bit, I'm a little unsure what to take from it, to be honest. It could be just kind of an artifact of how these things are coded, and there's definitely variation in how the states do that coding. And in theory, you know, the fact that people are in Victoria, according to the data, are more likely to be new or readmitted could, in theory, again, even mean that people are able to access treatment. But it is likely that there is a retention issue in Victoria. And the key piece of context that makes us think that really needs to be looked into is exactly the phrase you used, unmet demand. So according to both survey data, especially the National Drug Strategy Household Survey, which is held every couple years and is a massive survey about drug and alcohol use, and according to both that survey and wastewater analysis, there is higher opioid use in Victoria than in New South Wales, for instance, both heroin and prescription opioids. But the pharmacotherapy treatment rate in New South Wales is almost 50% higher per capita. So it seems extremely likely that we're missing people in need in Victoria. And in that context, adding this indicative data about retention issues really raises some eyebrows. And, you know, it sort of seems to suggest that we need a hard look at the system.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in that vein, what changes do you want to see implemented by the Victorian government to ensure that these issues are addressed? And have you seen any indication that there is the political will to appropriately invest in pharmacotherapy provision?
Yeah, indication, yes. Appropriately invest, not so much. You know, the government is not totally turning a blind eye. They know that, you know, that people have had many complaints about the level of investment in the system for many years, and they committed modest funding to pharmacotherapy in community health centers in 2024. And we also know that there's ongoing discussion about reform. But so far, it's been a bit of a Band-Aid, and there really needs to be just more investment throughout the system. So starting with just a proper diagnostic assessment, what is the level of unmet demand? What are the key barriers to access and retention? How does stigma play into those things and what to do about it? And then we need more investment in building resiliency. including through public hospital and community health capacity. You know, one big issue in pharmacotherapy treatment can be geography, so we need mobile services. And then definitely we need more incentives for doctors to actually prescribe and take on patients. You know, in general, in the alcohol and other drug sector work, you know, throughout the sector, workforce is a huge concern. So we really need sustained investment there. And even in collaborative care networks, right? So you need doctors, pharmacists, nurses, people, you know, to not be siloed off, because what we find is that sometimes some of the high volume prescribers in particular are siloed off from broader social services and broader health services that are necessary for holistic care.
Yeah, I mean, that siloing does also, you know, it sounds like it kind of parallels something that I've noticed in the psychiatric system and the siloing of psychiatric treatment from the rest of, you know, most people's access to psychiatric to psychological support and care. Now, I wanted to ask about the role that the Commonwealth government has in ensuring that pharmacotherapy access needs are appropriately met across the states and territories. And here I'm thinking about, you know, there is a current consultation ongoing for the drug and alcohol program at the federal level. And I know that Pennington Institute put in a submission, and that submission really highlighted the importance of harm reduction and harm minimization. So I was hoping that you could speak to that, and also, you know, the importance of integrated supports for harm minimization in opioid pharmacotherapy.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, you know, first of all, well, the drug and alcohol program, what it is one of the Commonwealth government's main funding mechanisms to back up the national drug strategy. And the national drug strategy is built, you know, it defines harm minimization as being built on several pillars: harm reduction, demand reduction, supply reduction. And harm reduction is sort of the neglected pillar. It's not formally included in the drug and alcohol program grant guidelines or in the program logic as a formal pillar, unlike prevention, treatment, and early intervention. And it just generally has been, including in an evaluation report by KPMG and the University of Queensland, it was just noted that harm reduction has been neglected in the drug and alcohol program. And in general, we know that harm reduction receives a pittance in Australia's drug budget, less than 2% of the money that is spent on countering drugs in Australia. So in general, harm reduction needs to be thought of as a core principle throughout the government responses to AOD issues. Now, pharmacotherapy is kind of interesting because it's both harm reduction and treatment, right? So it sort of fits into both categories. But again, the Commonwealth has a key role because, among other things, that's where the money is, right? Like, so a lot of the care for pharmacotherapy, especially in Victoria, comes through Medicare payments. And those Medicare payments need to be sufficient so that, you know, people have incentives to participate. Proper care for people experiencing opioid dependence takes time. And, you know, sometimes it comes down to relying on the community spiritedness of this small cohort of prescribers, and the money needs to be there so that doctors, you know, are inclined to participate. And we'd also love to see the federal government put more money into things like better training for all doctors and other health workers on combating stigma about people who use drugs and things like that. But overall, what we want is, as you said, we need research on care models that are really just effective, not just at ensuring basic pharmacotherapy access, but also really increasing people's overall well-being in a sustainable way.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking us through that. Is there anything else that you wanted to add before we wrap up today?
No, I mean, I think that I'm glad to have had the opportunity to talk to you about this. I mean, it seems like something that may not be relevant for most people, but it is, you know, it is a system that absolutely just saves lives and, you know, and really has benefits for both individuals and for, you know, the community as well. So it's really important to get it right. We know how to do it, and we just need to invest to make sure it's done.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for taking us through this, and a very informative conversation. And we'll include some information in our show notes about how people can access Pennington Institute's research and reports on this as well.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And that was Dr. Jake Dizard, Pennington Institute Research Director, who spoke with us about Victoria's opioid pharmacotherapy treatment gap. Now, again, just sharing some resources. If you are in Victoria and you need pharmacotherapy-related advocacy, you can contact the PAMS Pharmacotherapy Support Line on 1-800-443 from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday. If you are requiring pharmacotherapy access, you can call the Victorian statewide-based AOD Support and Referral Pathway Direct Line on 1-800-888-236. That's 1-800-888-236 24/7. And remember, you can also access your local community health services or centers that may have AOD services and pharmacotherapy provision. And they can also provide you with some of that support and advice. Also, just a reminder to everyone to carry naloxone around and learn how to use it. And Harm Reduction Victoria does provide training online every month to support people to upskill, and also provides people with free naloxone. And if you do need urgent support, you can always go to urgent care and emergency department services. And for the broader suite of support services around social, food, welfare, and housing, you can always head to Ask Izzy. And thanks so much, Inez, for sharing these resources with us, because you are the resident expert on AOD. But shall we just do a quick rundown of what we had on the show?
Absolutely.
So first up, we replayed an interview between Willow and Alara speaking about experiences of everyday transphobia in Britain that aired as part of Willow and my Trans Day of Audibility special broadcast segment. And you can listen back to the whole of TDOA 2026 on 3CR by heading to 3cr.org.au/TDOA2026.
And then we heard Leela's interview with Lee and Finn, where they spoke about the politics of sickness and broader liberatory politics and what it means to have not just community care, but how do these intersectional principles really show up every day, and reflecting on the social model of disability and what informed care can look like every day.
And after that, we heard a segment from Done by Law, who caught up with Stacey, who's a trans writer and advocate with lived experience of incarceration and who does vital decarceration work with Beyond Bricks and Bars. And they spoke about the key challenges that trans and gender diverse people face in prison, as well as transiting into the community and reintegrating, as well as ongoing administrative challenges such as banking that keep people vulnerable.
And then lastly, we had Pia's interview with Dr. Jake Dizard, the Pennington Institute Research Director, who unpacked Victoria's opioid pharmacotherapy treatment gap. And according to Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, the most recent National Opioid Pharmacotherapy Statistics Data Collection Report, Victoria is lagging behind other states and territories in crucial areas, including the public provision of pharmacotherapy services, treatment and retention, and matching rates of opioid use.
Yeah, well, a packed show today, and we look forward to catching you all next week on Thursday Breakfast on 3CR. And for now, we will love you and leave you, and make sure to stay tuned to Lost in Science.
Bye.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.